I'm Karen Hartglass. You're listening to It's All About Food. Happy January 8th, 2013. And once again, I want to tell you also on my website, Responsible Eating and Living, I've recently put together my best real reads for 2012. Some of the books that I've read and the authors that I've interviewed, I've posted my five favorites. And not all of them were published in 2012. They just happened to be books that I read in 2012. So they're my best reads. And I recommend going to that link because some of those books were really outstanding. In fact, one of my favorites of the favorites was Peter Seidel's Invisible Walls, While We Ignore the Damage We Inflict on the Planet and Ourselves. I really learned a lot, and it was pretty inspiring. Okay, now I am going to bring on another responsible eating. No, I'm going to bring on another Progressive Radio Network host. Charlene Spretnak is going to join me in this half. She is the author of several books that propose a map of the terrain and an interpretation of various emergent social movements and intellectual orientations. She has helped to create an eco-social frame of reference and vision, focusing particularly on modernity, its discontents, and the corrective efforts that are arising. And so much on her. She's written so many wonderful books. Her most recent one is Relational Reality, New Discoveries of Interrelatedness That Are Transforming the Modern World. We're going to talk a little bit about that now. Charlene, welcome to It's All About Food.
Thank you.
Wow. I was looking at the Relational Reality book and all the different topics that you covered, and it's, I don't know how you fit it all into one book. It's just, each one of those chapters is like books, several books.
That's true, because so much is happening right now about this, and it's, I put it in the context that in the last quarter of the previous century, there were a lot of bestsellers about discoveries in certain areas of science. First it was physics, and then chaos theory, and then complexity studies. And each of these books said, well, now that these discoveries have shown that the world isn't mechanistic, it's really dynamically interrelated, this is going to ripple out and change all our institutions and our systems of thinking. And we can look around and see that that didn't happen.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
Our institutions. And I think it's because those discoveries were too abstract for most people to relate to or pay much attention to. So I started thinking actually about 10 years ago, well, maybe I'm never going to see this shift into the relational understanding of the way the world works in my lifetime. But then I started noticing small articles in the newspaper starting around 2004, and there's a whole wave of new discoveries, which we're still in the thick of, and a lot of them are about physiology. They're also in other areas, and they're very concrete, very accessible, and they're changing, really changing all the institutions.
That's good news.
Yeah, well, so that's why there's so much in this book. And after this book went to press in 2011, of course, the story just kept breaking. So that's my radio program altogether now is actually tracking this relational shift. I have guests on from different areas where it's happening. And one of them, there was an article in The New Yorker, October 22nd, the whole microbiology, the whole field of microbiology is moving on to the relational model and off the mechanistic model. They always said, with the mechanistic lens, that if you have a virus or a bad bacteria in you, that makes you sick. But now they found out that's not at all how it works.
I was fascinated by that when I read it.
Yeah, isn't it amazing?
Yeah.
And they say, you know, if we compare a well group of people and a sick group of people, say with Crohn's disease or diabetes or obesity or asthma, it's not that the sick group is lacking, let me put it the other way. It's not that the well group is lacking a bad bacteria. Both groups may have a bad bacteria in their system, but the well group has the good bacteria that suppresses, it works in relationship and suppresses any damage the bad bacteria can do. So now they say, oh, they literally say, we see now, it's not like a war. Medicine shouldn't be viewed as a war against pathogens. It should be like ecology, tending a forest or tending the fields. And all we need to do is design these probiotics with the right good bacteria that a person's missing, instead of going in there and carpet bombing the whole system with these broad spectrum antibiotics. So that's how extensive this shift is. It's really happening everywhere.
I like the concept of connecting the dots, that everything is related, and also the fact that things that we learn on a macroscopic scale are so similar to what's going on a microscopic scale. War on any level is not a good thing. War against our body, war against individuals, war against countries.
Right.
We need cooperation. We need to work together.
And also the fact that medicine trained all the young doctors to just sneer at nutrition if anybody asked them, should I be eating something because of this illness I have? I mean, you know, they would just glare at you like, you stupid peasant, what are you talking about? But now, I mean, just a few that I mentioned in the chapter on health and healthcare in relational reality, you know, they're finally really acknowledging that food has not only preventative powers but curative effects as well. So with all these different diseases now, they do say food is going to help you if you follow these certain diets. Like, for instance, that ketogenic diet, it's a 4-to-1 or a 3-to-1 ratio of fat to protein and carbohydrates. That's been found to control seizures in patients with epilepsy that's resistant to medication.
Right.
And anti-inflammation diets can control symptoms in a whole range of chronic diseases in midlife and old age. And then the low glycemic diet is now used to treat macular degeneration. And the low-fat weight loss has been found to reduce the chance that people with pre-diabetic syndrome will go ahead and develop type 2 diabetes. So, and mood disorders, especially involving sugar cravings, you know, they respond to dietary changes. So this is a big shift in mainstream medicine to look at food that way.
Well, you mentioned you don't know if you're going to see these changes in your lifetime, and
Now I do.
we see changes, but I'm often frustrated at how long it's taking.
That's right.
Because there's so much information out there, and even with the internet, it's really hard to get it so that people are convinced that it's credible, and it's going to take a long time. So we can go back in history and look at things that happened 100, 200 years ago and say, oh, okay, those things happened and that didn't take too long, but while we're living it, it seems like an eternity.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the things I wonder about in the book, too, because when we went on to the mechanistic model, after the scientific revolution, which was in place by the end of the 17th century, and then throughout the 18th century, it was called the new mechanical philosophy based on the new science, and it just changed all the institutions, the way schools were designed, even garden design in France, and the way the economy was theorized, everything like a machine. So I started thinking, well, if it took 100 years back then, shouldn't it go faster now because of all our high-speed communication? But, you know, we're past the 100-year mark of Einstein's first two papers that said, oh, the world is really not like we think. It's not a mechanistic clockwork. So it is going longer, but because of these new discoveries, it's really getting attention. And as I say, it's not only around the edges this time, it's smack dab in the middle of places like microbiology.
Now, you sound very upbeat and very positive, and I like to keep a very positive, upbeat feeling myself because, you know, we have a choice in life. We can be miserable or we can be happy, and it's a choice. It's a perspective, and it feels a lot better to feel good than to feel bad. But putting that aside, do you feel optimistic because with the economy the way it is and the choices that are being made in our government, it just seems like we just keep making one mistake after the next. I mean, so many things for the environment, let's say, could have happened around Jimmy Carter's range that we didn't choose to do, and we wouldn't be here today with all these problems. But we didn't make the right choices.
No, we didn't, and it sounds like you're much younger than I am, but people my age just are grinding our teeth because even when a good thing happens, it's like, we tried 40 years ago to get that to happen. So I totally get that frustration, and It is very maddening with what's going on in Washington, because we can't get any of the votes for the public good as long as every vote is corrupt in the direction of needing to please the big donors for campaign contributions. You know, without campaign finance reform, every vote is corrupt, and we never get the votes for the public good.
Right.
Even saving the future generations from this horrible extreme weather that's picking up speed more and more every year, can't even get those kind of votes, like a carbon tax. So, yeah, it's very exasperating what's going on in Washington.
Now, this concept that you have, I haven't read any of your writing, and I'm definitely going to dive in very soon because it just all looks phenomenal. But this whole relational concept, just an example, I forget when it was, but we had a big movement to eliminate acid rain and to seal the ozone layer so that we didn't have a hole. And there was quite a focused effort in government and in technology to make improvements there. And I want to believe that we can do the same thing and relatively quickly if we all focused and got in line together.
Yeah, well, I look back at that and, you know, it was really a matter of those particles that were going up from aerosol cans and cooling systems, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess those were kind of small, although everybody had them in their houses. They were big by number, but not a huge part of the manufacturing sector. So they were able to be muscled and say, change the way you know, the heating, the cooling fluid that you're using, and replace, you know, pumps to replace the aerosols on all the household stuff. But there's just so much bigger players right now, meaning the whole oil and natural gas industry. I think it's just appalling that they're actually putting us on an export model now to wreck the country, so we not only would be self-sufficient, but beyond that, these people could just trash everything so they could make money exporting oil and natural gas with the fracking. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just too big. There's
it's,
just the big,
it's
the problems
really
big, are too
and
big.
Until we get so the parties aren't desperate for those big campaign contributions, nothing, I think, is going to move. Although, you know, we have seen that when people really turn out at the polls, that gets their attention.
Right.
And money couldn't buy the votes they thought it could last time, because people, working people who are really going to be affected, just woke up and turned out at the polls. So, you know, we always have that if we can organize well enough.
What do you recommend people do on an individual level? Because for me, that's where I know we have control. We can do things personally ourselves. We don't need laws to change in order to do things in our own lives to make this planet a better place.
Well, we can, and that's important. But, you know, it's hand in hand with the structural changes. The lifestyle changes are very important. For one thing, you can connect your personal changes, things, choices that you're making with how it affects your community and your region and the country. And I just want to say, I wanted to fit this in somewhere.
Yeah, okay, now's the time.
Food, the title of your show, I think, is so great, because more and more I come around to that. It's all about food. And I was telling someone about the community-based economics model that's always been the Green Party's economic platform, and, you know, building up trade in a town, a city, a region, trading with the states around you. Not that there's anything evil in long-distance trade, but you're really vulnerable if you're basing everything on conditions in some distant place, and it's not ecological to be shipping everything around the world. So you're much more secure with keeping money circulating in your region. And we talked about this. I would give talks to both middle-class audiences and activist groups and inner-city groups, and everybody would say, well, it sounds really interesting, but where is this working, Charlene?
Mm-hmm.
And the most I could do was talk about certain projects, places like Eureka, California, had a number of community-based economy projects going on successfully, but not a whole town really given it their all. And so it didn't really get much traction until the farmers market movement just really took off and got spread all across the country in all kinds of neighborhoods, city and suburban and country. And then through the food markets, through the local farmers markets, people started getting what it means to support local businesses, and that if you buy from a local person, they're going to be putting the money into the community. They hire local accountants, local sign painters, local truck drivers, instead of sending it out to distant corporate headquarters, you know.
It is all about food.
Also, some farmers markets have, you know, people come and sell things they've made that aren't food. They're almost like market days, the old European market days.
Yeah.
So really, the whole idea, the reason people kind of get community-based economics now, came out of the food market.
Right.
But we didn't guess that. We couldn't figure out that food was the catalyst.
That's right. You know, I appreciate you telling me that, because I personally do believe it's all about food, and that's why I talk about it all the time. But I'm looking at the chapters and the outline for your relational reality book, and I'm thinking I could probably link every one of these items listed here with food.
Uh-huh.
Because I think everything is related to food, at least through my rose-colored glasses. the farmer's market is really an amazing thing, and it's a great place to start. It's the community.
Yeah, and once you get the idea, if we had a green belt of farms around the town, you know, we wouldn't be vulnerable to what happens on the industrial food grid far away. So, yeah, I think it's really an idea that people are, you know, not associating with left or right or anything, just common sense.
Common sense, gosh. What a concept.
Yeah.
But it requires thinking, which I think is challenging for a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, a big step is, as you know, getting the local institutions to buy from the local farms. So the public school cafeterias, the county
farm-to-table
concept, cafeteria, anything, any kind of taxpayer-funded operation that buys food should be buying, at least a certain percentage that could increase a bit every year from the local sources.
You know, there's so much going on in the world, and I appreciate that we are now a global economy. We're connected with the entire world, and there's so many things going on everywhere, and many of us in the United States are far more privileged in terms of the stuff we have and the things we have access to than most other parts of the world. But that said, I really believe in getting involved in our own communities and strengthening them as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, it's such a, I won't say desperate. It's a very serious time. People need to work, you know, I say, as you were mentioning, the individual choices, how's this going to affect the community. They also need to put their time or effort, or at least send the check in to organizations like 350.org, who are really trying to organize public opinion for the global climate disruption. So, you know, we really need to show up and be present on all levels right now.
Right. It's a hard time because a lot of people don't have that extra cash to give away.
Yeah.
But if you don't have extra cash, maybe you can find a way to volunteer.
Well, that's what 350 says. I mean, Bill McKibben did a tape, you know, for fundraising, and he said, even more than money, we need money, but even more than money, we need for you to turn out. You know, they're having a big demonstration, I think, in front of the White House in mid-February, President's Day Monday. And they want that also replicated in all the cities across the country. So there are lots of ways people can get involved and be counted. You know, that's the thing. The opposition, the coal and oil, needs to not be able to think, oh, we've got them all divided and they're apathetic and it's not a problem anymore. You know, they can't really fight when the numbers turn out.
Well, but is that really the best way? Is that the best way to make a difference? Because, you know, I know that I've participated in some rallies and there were thousands or hundreds of thousands and then nothing happened and it was frustrating and it keeps you from wanting to go out again. Letter writing, I know, when you send out an actual letter on a piece of paper with a stamp on it, seems to hold a lot of weight. But what do you think the most effective form is?
It has weight because they have a formula. They multiply it. Like if they say one constituent wrote a letter, that really means 22 hold this opinion in the district. You know, they have these formulas for how to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
So it does definitely count more than your one letter. Well, you know, I definitely have felt that. And I come back to what Gandhi said when someone asked him in the middle of the independence struggle, which lasted decades in India, when they were trying to get the British Raj out of India. And someone said to him, what good could it do that I, one person, would do anything in this giant campaign? And Gandhi said, yes, you're absolutely right. Nothing you could do as an individual will make the slightest bit of difference. But it is absolutely essential that you do it.
Right. Every drop in the bucket fills
you know,
the bucket.
You don't know the effects, and we don't know where critical mass is.
That's right.
So it's just a matter of throwing your weight, you know, on the side of the angels. I mean, there's just important work to be done to stop the destruction.
Charlene, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. You can hear more about Charlene and her work every Thursday at 3 p.m. here on the Progressive Radio Network, or go to her website, charlenespretnak.com, and read all of her books. Thank you, Charlene.
Thank you.
Have a great week. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me, and have a delicious week.